Good morning, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center conference call. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC, and your host. So I'm going to provide a short introduction to the work of the JPC before we get to our speaker. We are a 501c3 organization providing perspectives and analysis of foreign and domestic policies by leading scholars, academics, and commentators. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. Organizationally, we sit slightly to the right of center, and we advocate for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, and energy security, as well as free speech and intellectual diversity. In this series of calls, as you probably are aware by now, we have been trying to shift the focus from the health aspects of the Wuhan virus pandemic to its impact on the internal and foreign policy choices of countries that are America's friends and that are America's adversaries. Today, we're looking at Turkey, which is by turns both America's friend and America's adversary. Remember, before we begin, you are muted, but you certainly can send us questions. Please send your questions to info@jewishpolicycenter.org. That's info@jewishpolicycenter.org. Our guest today is Harold Rode, an expert on Turkey, but more important, an expert on Islam itself, a protege of the great scholar and historian Bernard Lewis, and a former senior official in the Pentagon. Harold has devoted his life to exploring Islam and its historical richness. He has lived and studied in Iran, Turkey, and many parts of the Arab world. As a Pentagon official working in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, he observed the reemergence of Islam and the threat that would pose to liberal democracies around the world. Harold Rode received a PhD in Ottoman history from Columbia University, and he is currently a distinguished senior fellow at the Gatestone Institute and a senior fellow at the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. And lest you think this is all esoteric stuff, in May of 2003, Harold was working for the Pentagon in post-Saddam Iraq when over 2,700 books and tens of thousands of documents relating to the 2,300 years of Jewish life in Iraq, which ended in the middle of the 20th century, were discovered in the flooded basement of the Iraqi intelligence headquarters. Harold was intimately involved in the initial recovery, freezing and shipping, and vacuum freezing of material to prevent mildew, and the identification and restoration of the materials, which ultimately were displayed at the U.S. National Archive. It was an amazing achievement. With that, Harold, I turn the microphone over to you.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here. I think you and I know each other for way over 40 years or something like this. And I've always respected and honored you because you ask such marvelous questions. That's the key here. Now, in order to understand Erdogan and his policy, Erdogan, the G has a little line over it. So I'm going to say Erdogan, as you say in Turkish. It looks like Erdogan. A little bit who he is and what he is. And that will help us understand why he is doing what he is doing. Now, he has been, since he grew up, an Islamic fundamentalist. He never lied. He speaks really only Turkish and a smattering of Arabic. And unfortunately, most of us here in the West don't understand his mentality, the way he speaks, and what he means. Now, let's start for a very simple thing. What is Islam? In the West, when we hear religion is a personal matter between man and God. And it's their own business. If they want to pray five times a day, if they want to fast every day of the year, it's their business. We don't care. But Islam is not just a religion. Islam is a civilization with extremely important political elements. There is in Islam no separation between church and state, or mosque and state, if you wish, in this instant. all Muslims, by definition, are brothers. They look out for each other, they're supposed to. That doesn't mean that they're not very good at killing each other, because historically they have. And so when the modern secular Republic of Turkey was founded really in the around 1921, 22, I forget the date, it can be looked up. It was what Atatürk, the founder, did was remarkable. He tried to make the identity of the people, instead of your nationality, which in Turkish identity cards was listed as Islam, Muslim. He tried to break that and say, we are all Turks. What is the definition of a Turk? Supposedly it was to be anybody living in what was the state of Turkey. Well, that's the way we understand things. Americans are loyal to America, Canadians to Canada. The borders are sacrosanct. They mean something, but not for Muslims. What matters is family. What matters is large social groups, connections. And the borders of a country are alien to Islam. There are only two, if you wish, political entities in the world. The world of Islam and the world that of war, which will eventually become Muslim. It's a permanent thing. And that's how we have to understand Erdogan. Because if you listen to his speeches in Turkish, he's a marvelous orator. Then you see who the man is. But unfortunately, Arabic, Turkish, and Persian are languages that we here in the West don't really understand. And we Americans especially are looking for moderates all over the place. And so the moment someone says something nice, they believe that, you know, everybody is equal and all that sort of thing. Oh, they're moderates. Sometimes they say these things, leaders, knowing what we want to hear, to bamboozle us. And that is Erdogan. What happened was that he hated secular Turkey. He hated Atatürk. And what was, he was a protege of a man, a political leader by the name of Erbakan. Erbakan led a fundamentalist party in the 90s, Turkey, which took over. It was simply a political arrangement that the military at the time, which was at the time secular, and it is not today, the military thought it could handle it. And what Erbakan did was he tried to re-Islamify Turkey. We're not talking religion. We're talking political identity. Take it basically out of the West and reorient it again to Turkey's traditional role, which was to head the Muslim world. And he moved very quickly, and the military then basically had a, they call it an EKU, E for like internet, for email, that sort of thing. And he was out of power. What did Erdogan and his colleagues learn from this? And that is, you have to do things slowly, slowly. In Turkish, yavaş yavaş, which is, lawyers don't try to do things overnight. Say nice things, disarm your enemies, or your potential enemies, and slowly but surely, like the drip, 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 slowly but surely, to try to get your goals accomplished. And what Erdogan went out of his way to do was hire a whole bunch of advisors who spoke beautiful English and had beautifully tailored suits to come and represent him and to say the nicest things about how Erdogan wants to get along with us. And the whole goal was to hide their real goal, of which was to re-Islamify it, and that Turkey should resume its classic role of being the center of the Sunni world And from their point of view, God willing, or Allah willing, they should take over the entire Muslim world. And slowly but surely, Erdogan and his cohorts chip away at the political establishment. They bamboozled very senior leaders here in this country. And I don't want to name names because some of them are in fact friends. Because we desperately wanted to see moderate Muslims. And if they say nice things, everything is fine. I'll give you a personal incident that I had many years ago when Erdogan finally became prime minister. He came and spoke at a think tank in downtown Washington. And a friend of yours and mine, Shoshana, asked that I want to come, and so I came. And at the end of his lecture, which was totally political, he said, "Would you like to meet Erdogan?" I said, "Okay, why not?" So he takes me up there. Erdogan recognizes, knows who that this person is. And we're standing there, and I'm listening to the conversation that Erdogan is having with his advisors. It has nothing to do with politics. It has to do with a hotel which was being built in Istanbul. And Erdogan was extremely angry that they built it higher than other buildings. And he's a very emotional man. And then at one point he screamed the words, "Alevi Köpek." Alevi is it's not a Sunni religion, but it is in Turkey. There are maybe 20-30% of the population are not Sunnis. And they are this, they believe, they're called Alevis. They are certainly much closer historically to Shiism. Sunnis say awful, awful things about them. Köpek means dog. In other words, the builder of this hotel was an Alevi. He is a dog. A dog, I'm trying to think of an appropriate word in English. It's one of the worst things a Muslim can call somebody else. And I'm listening, and I'm like, Erdogan had no idea who I was. And he realized, he thought I was an American, he would know that Americans don't know Turkish. And here is this man being himself. In other words, he is a Sunni fundamentalist. Let me prove in Erdogan's own words. You know, he's won as prime minister. He's now president, and now he's gone on to dictator. As prime minister, he won a series of elections. And you can see on the net one of his victory speeches, in which he's talking in Istanbul, and he says, "This victory today is as important here in Istanbul as it is in Damascus. It is as, to the best of my knowledge, Damascus is the capital of a foreign country. It's not Turkey. It's the capital of Syria. This battle, this victory is as important in Izmir, a big city on the Turkish west coast of Turkey, as it is in Sarajevo. Sarajevo is the capital of Bosnia, another country." And then he says, "It's important as it is in Ankara, as it is in," he says, "Kudus." And Kudus is Jerusalem. In other words, I'm not interested in Turkey, per se. I am interested in reestablishing the Ottoman Empire. He talks about it in Turkish, or he used to, as the Ottoman area. I spent about 2 years ago a week in Skopje, the capital of Macedonia. And I don't speak any South Slavic language, meaning Croatian, Serbian. There's a language called Bosniak. Bosniak is what the Muslim, it's a form of Serbo-Croatian, which the Muslims speak. It's really all one language. And I certainly don't speak Albanian, which is the major language of the Muslims in Skopje. I remember going for a day to you cross a river in Skopje, and the whole area, it looks like an Ottoman city, and it is all these locals there, and you would think that you were all of a sudden in a foreign country, not in Macedonia, which is the largest group is Macedonian Christian. Why? First of all, the men all have beards. The women are totally hijab covered in, they're covered. And I began to walk around. And frankly, I used to know a lot more, a lot of Quran by heart. And my accent is Arabic. And I was going into mosques and talking to people. They all thought I was obviously a Muslim. And I was asking these people, you know, there were pictures of Erdogan. There were Turkish flags everywhere. Remember, we're in Macedonia and I'm in an Albanian area, and the Albanians are Muslims. And I'm just surprised. And they're telling me how great, when I say they're telling me, the older people still could speak a bit of Turkish, and I can certainly communicate in Turkish. And the younger people did know a smattering of English. Erdogan is our leader. He is number one. Why? He's bringing all these mosques. He's bringing us preachers. And the preachers that are teaching us Islam. Now, this is Muslim fundamentalist Islam, which was not common, this type of Islam, in among the Albanians before. They were much more European-oriented. But Erdogan's goal there and in Western Europe and, frankly, in Jerusalem right now is he's doing the same thing. Slowly but surely, he is infiltrating his form of Islam, which, by the way, I must tell you, the Saudis and the Gulfies, Qatar is the center of this form of Islam. And Qatar funds Turkey galore for all sorts of things and is funding, building all these beautiful, beautiful mosques. And I can only tell you that this is what Erdogan is trying to do first, shall we say, Islamify the politics, the political direction of what was the former Ottoman Empire. He is actively doing the same thing in Germany, where there are supposedly about 3 to 4 million Turks. My experience in Germany is that there are a lot more than that. And after you eventually Islamify, make people convert the Germans to Islam, when you may think this is fanciful, but believe me, they're doing a good job. You're going to continue the Ottoman battle. The Ottoman Empire existed to spread Islam, its form of Islam, Sunni Islam, throughout the entire world. The bottom line, that's what Erdogan wants to do. And he has been rather successful. Now, I mentioned Jerusalem. Why Jerusalem? The truth is, we very incorrectly keep calling Jerusalem the third most holy site in Islam. The Saudi intellectual godfather is a man from lived in the 1300s named Ibn Taymiyyah. Ibn Taymiyyah hated Jerusalem. He hated Jews as well, because he said this was nothing more than the Judaification of Islam. And he proved that. And the Saudis think that right now. Erdogan and the Muslim fundamentalists don't, their form of Islamic fundamentalism, don't think that Jerusalem is very important. Anything to get the infidels, in this case the Jews, out of that they should lose, that they should leave, they should whatever. It's Muslim, because once land is conquered by Islam, and Israel today was conquered in 637, 638 AD, CE, it's Muslim forever. And so Erdogan has a right to the entire area. It has a right. Now, I read Arabic, I speak Arabic, and I walk around the old city of Jerusalem, and I see there are a lot of institutions run by the Turks. And you see this, and it's like, what is going on here? What they're trying to do, Erdogan and his diplomatic establishment, is undermine the Israeli state. They are undermining Germany. They are undermining Macedonia, and they... basically, they think they have won in Turkey. But I want to say there are some interesting signs in Turkey. There is no one able to stand up against Erdogan. in Turkey, that's for sure, because he has all the levers of power. But what is happening among a lot of the younger generation is they hate Islam. What does hate Islam mean? I believe in God. I'm a deist, if you wish, they will say. But I don't want to have anything to do with Islam. For us, we're saying, oh, it's religion. Well, they're like us. Maybe they're like the West, which is unfortunately also left so much of religion behind to its detriment. But culturally, even if they are not religious and they may be deists, they are culturally Muslim because Islam is a culture. So will they eventually have power? I want to tell you, they are leaving Turkey in droves, going to wherever they can. And so I don't really see a way, even though there's so much discontent in Turkey, so much dislike of him, I don't see for the moment how he is going to, people are going to be able to stand up to him. There's simply no organized opposition. Anybody opens his mouth ends up in jail. Shoshana, let me leave it at that. And you go through questions. You take it over from here and I'll answer what you'd like.
Okay, thank you. That's a view of Turkey that we don't often see. So thank you for presenting that to us.
Thank you.
We have a number of questions. I'm going to run some of them together. But let's talk first about the potential security threat that Turkey represents to Western countries as a member of NATO. The question is, should Turkey be expelled from NATO? Can it be expelled from NATO? And how close is Turkey to Russia and Iran these days?
Well, a few things. It's not an ally anymore. Could it be in the future? I remember in the 80s, warning when I started to work for the Pentagon, we would go to these meetings in Turkey. And one of the greatest bosses and older brother friends that I've ever had, Richard Pearl, would have me talk with our people there and with our people at the Pentagon about what I saw going on in the Turkish military. Already by then, it was becoming Islamicides from below. They were, the military was the secular institution which guarantees the secularism of the Turkish state. And that was already being infiltrated. Now, Shoshana, I'm sorry, I lost my trend of thought here. Could you just give me a summary again?
Sure. I'm sorry. So what you saw then was the undermining of the Turkish military as a secular institution. So the question becomes, what do we do about that since Turkey is still a member of NATO? And how does that relate to Turkey's relationship to Russia and to Iran?
Okay. I don't know what the rules are of NATO, but I could say that NATO is not where Turkey's mind is. Turkey really wants to undermine so many of the NATO countries, again, through its pushing there of political Islam. I don't believe Turkey is an ally anymore. We can delude ourselves any way we want. Maybe it could be in the future. I don't see how that could be right now. So I wouldn't rely on Turkey in NATO. Absolutely not. I would try to formally dissociate myself from Turkey as much as possible. And here's among other reasons why. Erdogan wants, if we do formally say goodbye, Turkey, that's Erdogan wants that. See, it's proof for his people that the West hates us because we're Muslims. And they've just proved it by kicking us out. And they're kicking out because we're Muslims. That's going to be his argument. So I don't think we need to hand them that. But for actual everyday things, never trust them. That's one. Russia. Turkey, people know in Turkey that over the last 3-4 centuries, that the Turks have lost 13 wars to the Russians. There's no trusting of the Russians. But how could a NATO ally order, make a deal with Russia to buy, is it the X-300 missiles? How? They're supposed to, they're in Turkey and they're not being packed now. But this is all a game. Turkey knows very clearly that it cannot trust Russia. It will make noises to make us worry. Oh my God, we need to do whatever we can to keep Turkey in line. And we will therefore give in to things that it wants. These are, shall we say, quiet threats that Turkey is making. And our response to be is, oh, fine, if you do that, then you, and I think we have made it clear on the missiles, you bring in the Soviet or the Russian missiles. This is what's going to happen. And you, there's no need to scream at them in their face. You make, as just implied as their threats are, we can do exactly the same. And good luck to them. It's Qatar which is funding Turkey. And Qatar plays a game on both sides of the issue. It is a Wahhabi fundamentalist, viciously anti and pro-American country at the same time. How you can be pro and anti? It is the one supporting Islamic fundamentalism, specifically the Muslim Brotherhood, again, Erdogan, and the former Morsi in Egypt before Sisi took over. It's vicious anti-American activities everywhere. But at the same time, it has allowed us to build a huge base. It's our most important base in the Persian Gulf. And so by having us do that, it's like, oh, we don't want to make trouble in Qatar because we'll lose the base or we'll have to move it somewhere else. And it's $10, $11 billion. I don't know. It's something like that to make. What do we need this for? But let's go to Iran. Iran, I mentioned before, is like the KGB and the CIA when it comes to Turkey. They have had a standoff for at least 400 years. Iran is the center of the Shiite world. Turkey is the center of the Sunni world. The two of them, again, and unfortunately for them, there is no let bygones be bygones. There's no let's put the past behind us. There's no shaking hands and moving on. Iran and Turkey cooperate on certain things, but they are strongly opposed to each other on others. For example, in Syria, Iran supports Assad, the guy who runs Damascus. And Iran is, and the religion, if you wish, of Assad, he's not a Muslim. He's what is called an Alawi. And they are an offshoot of Shiite Islam. So Iran and Assad are natural allies against the Sunnis. Sunnis in Syria, they refer to the Alawis as Abid, which means slaves. And they treated them as such historically. And, you know, we hear about all these refugees that left Syria. If you look, I'm not interested in refugees per se, but I'm very interested in who are the refugees. And the area between Damascus up to Aleppo in the north in Syria was a wonderful breadbasket, which was overwhelmingly Sunni. Those are the ones that Assad has pushed out. They're the ones who came to Turkey. And Turkey basically has let them go to Europe, to Islamify Europe. At one point, there were about a million almost that came to Germany in 1 year. I think it was 2016. The Germans are now a little afraid. That's all right. So the answer is, we say, oh my God, look at what the Syrians are doing to each other. They don't see themselves as Syrians. They see themselves as Sunnis. And their natural ally is Erdogan. How many refugees, Syrian refugees, again, who are overwhelmingly Sunni, as I said, in Turkey? We don't know. There are various numbers bandied around, 3.5-4 million. And there are people who sneak in all the time. There are whole sections of Istanbul where the language is Arabic now. Syrians are much better businessmen than Turks, and the Turks are a little angry that the Syrians are coming in and really doing a pretty good job economically. And so the refugees become a weapon that Erdogan uses against Europe. Oh, vis-a-vis Turkey and Iran, they have had a quiet truce for, again, about 400 years. It heats up from time to time. But their interests in the Islamic world are inimical. They hate each other. The phrases in Turkish, the proverbs that the Turks and the Persians use against each other are simply awful. They're disgusting. And the reason why that's important is that proverbs are an insight, and stories that people tell are an insight into how people understand their world. Turks hate Iran, Iranians hate Turkey. Iran knows that it is the most cultured, most civilized, most important country in the Middle East. It's had a highly sophisticated urban culture for 2,600 years. And it's, interestingly, if you understand that and how China sees itself, China and Iran have been very close friends, have had a good relationship for, I don't know, it's millennia. And why? Because both see themselves as the center of the world, as highly sophisticated urban cultures, and they had nomads on their borders, which constantly tried to take them over and destroy them. Who are these nomads? They are the people of Central Asia. Who are they by and large? They're Turks. So they have a common enemy, the Turks. We see how the Chinese are dealing with the Turks in Xinjiang in northwest China, the Uyghurs, they speak Turkish. When I see it written, I can pretty much understand it. When I hear it, I have to hold myself from laughing because it's a dialect so different, but it is still very clearly Turkish.
So now, Harold, you're giving us a picture, which I think is fascinating, of not a unified space, but a space in which all different kinds of people operate. And yes. So I want to throw a couple of other people into the mix. We have about 10 minutes left. So let me ask you about two groups. First of all, Fethullah Gulen and his movement inside Turkey. And secondly, the Kurds, who we have a question from a listener asking if the Kurds are an ally of ours in the management of the Middle East.
Yes, the answer is let's go to Gulen because there was a huge rivalry, but Erdogan has effectively destroyed, for all intents and purposes, the Gulen movement, which has gone underground. They hate each other, to put it mildly. And remember, in the Middle East, if you're a Jewish organization, let's just say the following. Jews can scream and yell at each other, but very rarely throughout history do they hate each other. It happens, but it's rare. In Islam, when you disagree, you kill each other. Always? No. But it happened so often in history that there's no way even of counting these. And that is Gulen and Erdogan. They worked together until Erdogan didn't need him anymore. Disagreement, it's going to sound esoteric, it's religious, forget really, I'm happy to talk about it, but this won't really matter to us. What matters is they hate each other and Erdogan. Now, the military first in Turkey, taking it over, and then he's jailed all these people who used the Gulenist as an excuse for his fake coup. It was really, to me, from what I can figure out, Erdogan had a coup against himself so he could take over and then destroy his enemies. So I wouldn't think for the moment that Gulen, at the moment, matters much in Turkey. Kurds are a much more interesting story. And that is, unfortunately, as they have a proverb in Kurdish, a language I do not know. But it says the only friends that the Kurds have are the mountains. Because all the Kurds do is they kill each other, they disagree with each other. They are, yes, America's natural allies in the Middle East, but they don't all agree. For example, the Kurds who run Iraqi Kurdistan, it's really almost a separate country today, don't like the Syrian Kurds. The Syrian Kurds are by and large more connected to the Kurds in Turkey. How many Kurds are there in Turkey? And the largest Kurdish city in the world is Istanbul, which has maybe about 20 million residents, which maybe at least the third is Kurdish. Now, all of northern Iraq has about 4 million people. Istanbul has the one-third, it's like 7, 8 million Kurds. But what is a Kurd and how do they see themselves and why they are a natural ally of Arabs? The Kurds, according to their population figures, Erdogan has publicly said that by the year 2038, there will be an equal number of Kurds and Turks in Turkey. Why? Because the Kurds have a much higher birth rate than the Turks do, the ethnic Turks in Turkey. So, but I want to tell you that I have friends who used to work in the interior ministry in Turkey, and they made it very clear to me, no, we're there already. The country is pretty much 50-50 already. Now, are they united? The answer is, unfortunately, no. But is there a sense of being Kurdish? And who and what is a Kurd? And it's extremely important. I remember that my wife and I were in Turkey, and someone was nice and gave us a driver for us to do a car and a driver for a period of time. And this guy was already, I knew to ask these questions already. He is born in Istanbul. His father was born in Istanbul. His grandparents were Kurds that came from South Turkey. He already, the driver, was a grandfather. Everybody in from his father down, everybody married Turks, ethnic Turks. And you ask, and he, by the way, the driver knew nothing but Turkish. And you ask him who he is. And I can hear him, his words, two words, Kurd. Say, of course, I'm a Kurd. Why? Because his father is a Kurd. And his grandchildren, his son's children, they are also Kurds, even though some of them haven't even been to the southeast, which was the traditional Kurdish heartland. Where all this is going to end, I don't know. What are the Turks? You hear that, well, all that matters is we're Muslims. But frankly, even though they're both Sunnis, that is the Kurds and the Turks of Turkey, the Kurds, they have a different form of Sunnism. Hanafi, there are four major schools of Islam, of Sunni Islam. The Turks are ethnic, by and large, almost all Hanafi. Not totally, but almost. And the Kurds are almost what is called Shafi. Again, the religious differences. But the way the Turks refer to the Kurds, they say Shafi Kurpek. Again, that same word. The Shafis are dogs. They're saying Kurds are dogs. I don't know where all this is going to go. But there is no doubt that these people have an affinity towards America. Why? Because everybody else in the area wants to kill them. Remember, that's the right word. I don't like you. I'm angry at you. I kill you. This is so alien to the way that we think here in the United States and supposedly in Europe, although they've certainly been quite violent to each other throughout history. And we don't want to see it. But I definitely say there are many ways of which we can help and should be helping the Kurds, but I would definitely say don't get involved in all these differences. It's like, for example, the Israeli policy in Syria is really smart. They help people medically, but they did not get involved in the internal rivalry of these groups. You can only lose by doing this. We should not be involved. If we can certainly hear and help Kurds, because they are our natural allies. The only Muslim people that I really, who don't have an animus towards non-Muslim world, so, are the Kurds.
So let's move to a simpler country, Israel. Oh, wait, that's not simpler. But we do have some questions related to Turkey and Israel. First of all, what Erdogan is doing in the Eastern Mediterranean and its effect on Israel and its plans regarding a potential gas project with Cyprus. And secondly, if Iran collapses, how likely is it that Turkey becomes the leading anti-Israel state in the Middle East?
Well, let's go with the second first. Iran has, with whatever, it's multi-ethnic, whatever, the Azerbaijanis, which is the largest group actually in Iran, are Turks, but they think of themselves as the true Persian. I can't see Iran collapsing. I can see this government in Iran collapsing, and God willing, really, it is so fragile, it is unbelievable, and we can do interesting things to help there. That's one. But it will leave Turkey as the, as just as the questioner said, he's right, or she's right, whatever. Turkey will be the biggest enemy of Israel and the United States, because in the end, Turkey wants to Islamicize the world. We're not talking religion. We're talking bring it under Islamic rule. And once that happens, remember, there's no way out. The other question...
Erdogan getting in the way of the gas project.
See, in the Middle East, there's a lot of bluster. And people talk and talk and talk. Look, you know, Mahmoud Abbas, the terrorist who heads the Palestinian Authority, said, we cut off all all connections with Israel and the United States. Well, you know, when we get, oh my God. Well, the fact is, it's not true. There are certain things which will go underground a little, but some of them have already, people said, we're going to continue these things when it's in our interest. Believe me, it's in their interest in many, many ways. And that's the same thing here. The Turks, Erdogan can say what he wants, and it is very important for us to make sure in the West that our interests are taken care of, that we look after them. And Turkey pushes too far, our job will be to push Turkey a little bit. And you don't even have to say it, you have to do it. And you can have a few people, rumors gets, Middle East love rumors. All you have to do is have a rumor that X happened and Y was responsible for it. It's going to be all over. Everybody's going to hear it. And people believe in conspiracies. We think it's nuts. But that's how, since they have no idea how their governments function, and they're constantly, it's oh poor me. And so they believe in these things. Am I worried about it? I would say that America, Israel, our friends, in this case, we're also the Greeks and the Cypriots, we should be very aware of it, and to make sure that if the Turks do anything, that they pay for this, let's say. And we don't have to throw it in their face. They'll get the message. If they want to be involved in Libya, which is really how that economic, the oil area that they sort of built very beautifully on a map, good luck to them. Libya is a cesspool. It's not a country. It's three zones. They are completely unrelated to each other. There's the one which is closer to Tripoli, the one which is closer to, which is much more North African. On the other side of the Libyan desert, closer to Egypt, Cyrenaica, they are culturally much more like Egypt. And in the south is basically sand and desert. And these were cobbled together by the Italians as a country. There is much a country, I don't know. It's absurd. They have no common interests. Now, Turkey wants to be involved there, and good luck to them. It is a quagmire that good luck to Erdogan. He should be involved in the quagmire.
Okay, as a last question, because we're wanting to get out of here about 12:45, although I think we could do this for much longer, but we're going to stick to our plan. Give us give us a very quick answer here. Can Erdogan and his government overcome the economic and other effects of the Wuhan virus pandemic on Turkey's already weak economy? I know that's a big question. Can you give us a short answer?
Highly unlikely, but money-wise, they'll get whatever they need from Qatar. Qatar are just, all it is it's a money pot. We have no idea what the situation is in Turkey or the Wuhan virus. What we do know is that whatever they tell us is absurd. These leaders have to pretend they're in control, and they otherwise they'll be shamed. God forbid they be shamed. And so we don't know. We don't know what's going on in these countries, and we certainly don't know what's going on in Turkey.
That is a great place for us to stop. You reinforce the kind of natural skepticism that I think most of us have about non-democratic governments. And also, I think you've made clear for our listeners, certainly for me, how complicated the sets of relations are in the Middle East. And this, Harold Rode, we thank you. The Jewish Policy Center thanks you. And our listeners thank you.
Thank you, Shoshana. Nice to speak with you.